Well, I'm sure most of us have had those moments in life where we feel completely helpless. Something's going on, something that is often painful or sorrowful, and we can't do a single thing to impact the situation. For me, I remember the time during seminary when my oma or grandma was dying of ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. I was off in Wisconsin, and even if I could have made it out here to California, there was nothing I could have done. I also think of all the times I've seen families in hospitals get the news that a loved one needs surgery, or that a loved member of a large family is dying. But it's not just health or death. There are all kinds of situations like these. And we have all kinds of reactions when we get thrust into those moments. Some turn to God in prayer. Some get out of the situation and try to ignore what's happening. And some turn to God instead in anger, with blame and accusations. Many of them have that idea that God couldn't understand their suffering, or that God is hurting them. Well, what we just heard is one of the passages in the gospel that speaks clearly to us and to all people in these situations. If you remember from last week's passage, Jesus was in a boat headed to the other side of Galilee. Well, over there, he exorcised a man, got on the boat to come back to the side of Galilee he was on before, and that's where our passage picks up. Jesus has just landed, and he's approached by Jairus. Jairus is one of the rulers of the synagogue. That doesn't mean Jairus is a Pharisee or a rabbi at the synagogue. Jairus is more like an administrator. He keeps the synagogue in running condition, and he's probably the one who plans out all the services at the synagogue. He's not one of the teachers, but he's probably a very good and faithful Jew, trying to live his life the best that he can. And the impression we get in the passage is that he's been looking for Jesus frantically. The passage that we have doesn't start with later or after a while. It's then came. It sounds like Jairus is there as soon as Jesus gets off the boat. And Jairus isn't just politely asking the apostles if he could meet with Jesus. It says he fell at his feet and besought him. Most modern translations will say he begged him. And not only that, being a ruler of the synagogue, it probably wasn't good for Jairus to be seen talking to Jesus, let alone groveling and begging him like this. He could lose his job for this. Jairus is risking a lot here. So this isn't Jairus just bumping into Jesus and asking a question. This is Jairus frantic and desperately in need of help. He's there because his daughter needs Jesus. If you look carefully, Jairus doesn't say that his daughter is sick or ill. He says, my little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live. This is serious. In the Greek, if you look at Jairus' words at the end, that she may be made well, Jairus doesn't use the normal word for healing. He uses the word sozo. It literally means to save. This is the same word used when we talk about our salvation. It's the kind of word you'd use when talking about a lifeguard at a pool. So Jairus isn't asking Jesus to come and heal his daughter from an illness. He's begging, save her from the brink of death. So Jesus agrees to go with Jairus. Now, this attracts a crowd. Jesus himself would attract a crowd, But seeing Jairus in this shape is drawing people too. And if you look at the citation at the top of your scripture inserts, you can see that right here is where we miss about 11 verses. It's while walking to Jairus' house that a woman with a bleeding illness touches Jesus and is healed. It's a whole other miracle, and it gets its own Sunday reading. So we don't include it here in order to focus more on the healing of Jairus' daughter. But it's important to know about it because it delays Jesus. After this woman is healed, Jesus addresses the healing and starts teaching on it. We don't see it in the passage, but I could only imagine throughout it that Jairus is antsy. He's got Jesus, he knows help is coming for his daughter, but I'm sure he wants her to stop suffering. He wants Jesus to have been there yesterday. And then this interlude gets broken up by the next line. While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" It feels so painful even just to read it. Jairus' worst fear is being realized. It's not that they say, "Your daughter is getting worse, come quick." They literally tell him, "Your daughter is dead." And they don't even give this news in a loving or kind manner. You know, the next thing out of their mouths is, "Why trouble the teacher any further?" They're implying that all Jairus has done so far was bother Jesus. That what he's been doing is pointless. And it's something that we still hear today when people ridicule our faith. "Why are you doing that? What good is any of it?" My heart really goes out to Jairus here. This poor guy is getting kicked while he's down. However, thankfully, Jairus is with Jesus. And Jesus turns to Jairus and gives him this very short and direct response. Only four words. "Don't fear, only believe." And when I went to nursing school and seminary, I remember hearing things you never say to someone. Things like, "I know what you're going through," or "everything is going to be okay." Well, we can never truly know those things, so we shouldn't say them. Well, the one person who can know and can say those things is Jesus Christ. When we hear Jesus telling Jairus this, when we hear Jesus telling this to us in our own lives, it's definitive. It's certain. Don't fear. Not that fear is a bad or wrong thing, but that when we have Jesus in our lives, we don't have anything we need to be afraid of. Not to say everything's going to be hunky-dory or easy, but we don't have to be afraid because Jesus offers us something bigger and better than fear. And we get this when Jesus continues with the next part of that line. "Only believe." The thing that will get us out of that fear is believing. It's turning to Christ and focusing on him. And that's not just a belief, like we hold certain religious beliefs. It's a trust. The way we might believe in a friend, someone we've come to rely on multiple times. This is something we need to do continually in our lives, but especially when we've got a fear or anxiety that's trying to drown us. It echoes the words of Psalm 46, "Be still and know that I am God." And from this point on, the only people going further are Jesus, Jairus, Peter, James, and John. Jesus has left the crowd following him behind. And that's because in this situation, Jesus is the only one who truly cares about Jairus and his daughter. And we could see that more clearly when we get to Jairus' house. There's this crowd gathered there, and they're weeping and wailing. It sounds like they're distraught. But when he enters the house, Jesus tells them, "Why do you make a tumult and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." Now, people of faith hearing this from Jesus would probably be hopeful. People who are in grief hearing this would probably dismiss Jesus or get angry at him for spreading a false hope. But the people here just laugh. They're not there because they want to support Jairus' family or because they're upset. They're there because they want to be on a better social standing with the ruler of the synagogue. They're using this tragedy for their own gain. So Jesus kicks them out of the house. The only ones still there are the ones who came with Jesus and now Jairus' wife. These are the ones who are putting their faith and trust in Jesus. Then we get the miracle itself. Jesus tells the girl, "Talitha kumi." It's a command, a directive. "Little girl, stand up." But it's not this harsh command. It's one spoken with love. Jesus is reaching out to take her by the hand and help her get up. He doesn't just expect her to obey him by herself. He's working with her in this. And what we see is that Jesus hasn't just saved her from the brink of death. This isn't just a resuscitation. Jesus has brought her back to full health, to wholeness. That's why the passage explains that she's walking, and Jesus tells her that she can eat. She's all better now. She's been saved, and now she's whole. And this passage is so comforting because in a situation where no one truly supports Jairus, where the people who come to his aid are only doing it for their best interests, Jesus is there to support him, to help him, and to show his love for him. Even when the miracle takes a detour and Jesus helps the woman with the bleeding sickness, Jesus doesn't do this ignoring or abandoning Jairus. He does this knowing that eventually Jairus' daughter will be okay. And when it comes to us and our sufferings today, we need to see that we're in the same situation as Jairus. It's God is so different from us that he doesn't care about us. It's the exact opposite. Jesus has experience in this sort of thing. We need to turn to Jesus in our sorrow, in our grief, and ask for him to work in our lives. Things may get jumbled at times. It may look to us like it probably did to Jairus, that Jesus is somewhere else or not focusing on us. But he's always there, and he knows and wants what's best for us. This can be further compounded for us by the fact that we live on this side of the resurrection. We live in this awkward time after Christ's resurrection in Jerusalem, but before the general resurrection during his second coming, an event coming in the future that we mention in the Creed every week. We look for the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come. The truth is, when we face sickness, death, sin, in his crucifixion and resurrection, Jesus Christ has already acted to not just heal the world, but like with Jairus' daughter, to save the world. Not just to give it life, but to give it life in abundance. We're just waiting to see the completion of that salvation. And so, in the meantime, we need to listen to Jesus' words to Jairus before they get to the house. "Don't fear, only believe." That's what our coming here each Sunday should be. It should be a time for us to put away all the frustrations of the world, to focus on Christ, on the promises that he's made, and the hope that we have as Christians. And like each week, we have a time to do that shortly in the Creed, our statement of belief. Not only ours as a group, but ours as individuals. This week, when you confess those words, think about the implications they have. They're not just statements of abstract belief, like facts that we assert. They are true, but they are also statements of trust. These are the promises that Christ has given us, and they should give us hope in our daily lives. When I was struggling with this kind of thing, it was turning to God in belief and trust that helped me, that pulled me out of what could have been very, very deep fear and darkness. It wasn't just a belief in him, it was a reliance on him, that he was in charge of the situation and that there is no one better to be in charge. We need to conform ourselves more and more to this creed so it becomes a part of who we are and something reflected throughout our lives. We need to not just blindly recite this creed, we need to live the creed. And we need to faithfully trust in the one that we confess. If we do this, then when those depressing times come, when many people would despair or lash out in anger, we can be still and only believe. Amen.